Shonda McDill is the managing director of the Pittsburgh Public Theater. She is a rare type of new leader in the theater. Black women who are ascending to the top roles in major theatrical institutions across America. She has achieved her success by living life on her own terms and giving herself permission to tell her own story, a story founded in her strong, unshakable faith and lessons from the mentors who have helped shape her life. She has carved non-traditional paths in her approach to marrying her husband, in her approach to motherhood, and in her approach to living her life as a complete artist. As she says, she chose to struggle to produce the work in the way that she saw it should be done, not struggling to convince others of her own humanity. Hello and welcome to At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform that brings together people from a diverse background of lives, careers, and experiences who all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of finding and raising their voices to make an impact on the world we live in today. At the Podium holds a space for everyone to share their stories, to be heard, and to bring us inspiration. Today, I'm thrilled to share the podium with Shonda McDill. Shonda McDill is the newly appointed managing director of the Pittsburgh Public Theater and serves with the Black Women's Equity Initiative Steering Committee with the City of Pittsburgh. She has studied under Pulitzer Prize winner August Wilson, been directed by Intisake Shange, and instructed by Augusto Boal. McDill holds an MFA in theater management from Yale University's School of Drama and a BA from Dartmouth. With experience spanning dramaturgy, directing, producing, and playwriting, in 2006, she founded Damascus, a national theater collective that participated in the inaugural Build Residency at the August Wilson African American Cultural Center, supported by the Richard King Mellon Foundation. As a leader in the arts, Shonda also served as the program officer for arts and culture at the Heinz Endowments. She also co-managed the Advancing Black Arts in Pittsburgh initiative. Additionally, McDill contributed to the foundation's first cross-programmatic social justice initiative called Just Arts, which she helped to found, and the Arts Equity Reimagined Fund, aimed at providing an informed, equitable, and actionable response to the needs of the local arts community during and beyond the coronavirus pandemic. In Pittsburgh, Shonda previously served as Programming and Cultivation Vice President at the August Wilson Center for African American Culture and the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust's Director of Public Relations. She is a member of the Alpha Alpha Omega chapter of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated, and married to Homewood, PA native Sagra McDill, with whom she shares four children. Okay, Shonda, welcome to At the Podium.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure and an honor to be here.
It is such an honor to speak with you. And the way life works, when I reached out to you about coming on the show, I had no idea that you started at the Yale School of Drama the year I graduated. So I graduated in May of 2000, right? And then you started the fall of 2000.
I refuse to believe we are at the point where we can't say the thing, but it is, I mean, I am looking at my gray. I'm like, oh goodness. It's like, yeah, there's a career to talk about, which already lets me know, like, there are many generations behind us that are now doing the thing. But yes, I'm sad that we crossed paths. I probably would have loved being in community with you at that time, needed it. And so, yeah, but here we are. I love the way the world works.
That's the way the world works. And you say it beautifully that now we have careers to talk about. And what I reached out to you about is that you are currently the newly appointed managing director for the Pittsburgh Public Theater. And when we were speaking about your appointment, you said something to me that really touched me. You said you were almost overwhelmed by the responses and the support and how much it meant to people to see you step up into this really prominent role at this prominent American theater. And I wonder, why do you think it meant so much to people to see you step into this position?
I've been thinking about it since our conversation, and since additional things have happened in community to kind of celebrate the appointment. Yesterday, my husband called me. He said, you know, people were coming up to him because they announced it on the radio on WAMO here in town, which is the urban radio station. And a sister who's a disc jockey congratulated me on the radio. We had done some work while I was in philanthropy. I think it is because my trajectory has not been traditional. I think it's because it is rare to have an artist practitioner be sometimes in an administrative role. It's rare that I was in philanthropy representing and working with arts groups and then went back to nonprofit world. But throughout all of that, I think what's most important is that I've always advocated for community. And what I'm seeing now is community will stand with you too. And I've always known it, but it's showing up in a way that feels like so much love. And I think that's what I'm being overwhelmed by. And I'm just grateful for the presence of community in all of its facets, the multitude of people from various backgrounds who are saying, we're glad to see you there and we have your back.
I think that idea of community is powerful. And I think in the 2 years that I've been doing this show, there has emerged a theme about representation. And when I sat down to think about what At the Podium was going to be, representation was not really on my mind.
Right.
But organically, the story of representation has become very important.
Yes.
And I think that's why I didn't know who you were. And I was so proud because having a theater background, I know what it takes to step into those positions and what barriers, in the best case scenario, one has to overcome to step into those positions. And so it made me feel so proud for you and proud for our community, mm-hmm. our theater community, but our broader community as well. And I think that's why people really felt so personally about what's happened for your career.
I would agree with you. And you can see even in my answering it, I still don't see it so much always as I'm representing communities in this way, right? Or I'm representing, because we know we're not a monolith as a community. We know that there's often, for those of us who go to Yale or these prestigious institutions, that there is always this dichotomy that we're wrestling with around race and the dynamics of race, not only with those who are in majority positions, but also sometimes with our own communities, right? And so that's probably why I'm overwhelmed also, is to hear it from my community as well as other communities. And also, I think you're right, of course, to be a woman, although the Pittsburgh Public Theater had a woman who was a part of the founding group of three, but to be a woman and, of course, to be the first Black woman to be the managing director at the helm of this institution alongside Mariah C. Kaminsky is really something that I do understand is historic.
Mm-hmm. When I was doing some research on you, you talked about this idea of representation very powerfully around the founding of Damascus, mm-hmm. which was an organization that you founded. And what you talked about, what you wrote about Damascus was this, and I'm gonna read it. You said that you founded it with the hope of marrying historic and vivid storytelling with soulful and unapologetically Black and faith-filled work. You went on to say, I deeply wanted to provide an artistic home for artists where they felt just as comfortable failing as they did accomplishing their highest artistic achievements. I wanted us to be able to do that apart from the gaze of others that would be judging and measuring us and our art by a standard established without us in mind from inception. and you ask the question, who is us? And you say, us is anyone who wasn't thought of, who was excluded, or who had to put on a mask of another culture, value system, or prevailing system of beliefs in order to participate in the industry. I was fully aware that if I wanted to see the stories that reflected my experiences and the experiences of those who trained me professionally and personally, I would have to write, produce, and present them myself. Wow.
I mean, first, I have to say, when I hear it, I hear back those who taught me. I hear August Wilson's 1996 TCG speech at Princeton. I hear Antazaki Shange. I hear Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, right? I hear those who've taught me, Augusto Boal. I hear those who have mentored and taught me. And so when I speak to it, it is speaking to a legacy of people who understood that that it is necessary for us to tell our own stories if they are going to be told, that we must bear witness, as Toni Morrison says, to what happens and what has transpired in our lives and what, you know, maybe not even necessarily what ought to be. I laugh because Toni, right, if you listen to Toni Morrison, she says, I'll leave that to the sociologists,
yeah,
about what ought to be, but I can bear witness to what is for me. And I think that those stories are critical and important to our lives.
And I think, you know, you positioned what you wrote in such a way that I never thought about it like that, that the art that we're being held up against and these standards that we're being held up against are not, we weren't even part of that inception. That has no bearing on our history, our struggles, and that we're all in this fight to sort of live up to whatever this idea is that had nothing to do with us. When you extrapolate that out past theater, you start to think about, well, how does that impact how we look at the struggle for civil rights, the struggle for women's rights, the struggle that AAPI people are going through right now?
Yeah.
What is the struggle supposed to be?
Right.
Because they can't be trying to live up to these ideas that were not even made with us in mind. And it's quite a revolutionary way of thinking about struggle and how we mm-hmm. raise our voices mm-hmm. in the world.
Well, I think I chose to struggle to produce the work in the way that I saw it instead of struggling to convince others of my humanity. There's two struggles, right? There's the struggle to say, I'm going to stay, and oftentimes we find this in PWIs or in different places. It's probably the reason why I didn't land in Lort sooner than I have, right? It's because I'm going to either struggle in the system to kind of make you see me, or I'm going to struggle in and among my own struggle that we all have individually as human beings to tell the story in the most authentic way, whether you ever receive it or not, right? Mm-hmm. And this is not new. This is really the story of what Tyler Perry and Spike Lee talk about. It's like, whose story is the realest story or the truest story and has the most value and should be told when and where? And I think the reality is there's a place for all stories. There must be representation, but you cannot wait for other people to give you a place or wait for them to tell your story. And so it has to be me, right? And I guess it'll be me, myself. And that's what I've chosen to do.
I want to push back a little bit.
Yes.
Because you talk about you want to create a work that is unapologetically Black. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself as I was reading through the Manifesto of Damascus, and I love that name because of the On the Road to Damascus and all of the sort of the masks that we, there's, you know, it's quite a great name. But you talk about wanting to have work that's unapologetically Black and that represents your interest and your experiences and my experiences. On the flip side of that, then, do we have to make room for work that is unapologetically not Black? Or work that is unapologetically White?
Mm. I have to bring Toni in again. I feel like I just keep hearing, you know, her interview with Bill Moyer. I hear the history, right? So first of all, as a Black American, first of all, race is a construct, right? And I'm just saying this because if I had my own way, and there are people who do, they create their own language or they will not respond in a certain way. And so I want to begin by saying that I don't even believe in the construct of race. Now, having said that, I understand that I live in a country where race is a real thing. And to get to your question, there is no way that I cannot be influenced by Western European culture. My ancestors were enslaved Africans brought to a country where they were forced to create something that was the hybrid of the remnants of their regality and the influences of an oppressive culture and society, right? By force. And they created something magnificent and beautiful. They created us. They created Patrick Huon. They created Shonda McDillon. They created all of the ancestors and all the people who've come before us and are to come. So for one, I used to tell people I was raised a white woman. This is the double consciousness. I don't have to think about being unapologetically white. First of all, let's just deal with that, because I've been forced to learn the ways and the cultures and the systems of those who've been in power. The question about being unapologetically Black surfaces when you're just trying to be yourself in a society that seeks for you not to speak proudly about what it means to be that. My hope is that in doing that, And in our manifesto, we say it is going to be a part of some of the future writing that's going to be on the website. The hope is that that work can also be tied to the work of our brown brothers and sisters, to our Asian brothers and sisters. It should be all connected, right? So I think those are can be two different things, but I think it is the same thing. And I love also, I'll just close this question by saying, you know, again, when Toni Morrison was repeatedly asked this question about her writing, she would say, no one says to Tolstoy or James Joyce, when are you going to write about Black people?
Right.
You wouldn't question these great American writers, those who have never done it, because some have done it. When are you going to do that? So the question in and of itself becomes offensive because it speaks to what we think about the importance of the humanity of those who've been marginalized.
Mm. Yeah, it's like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asked how many women would be enough to be on the Supreme Court. She said nine.
Nine.
Nine. If we dial into this moment that we're in now in culture where we're really going for verisimilitude, like, you know, we loved back in the day, maybe we didn't, but people loved back in the day when Olivier put on blackface to play Othello. And I know people are going to lose their mind when I say this, but I want to know, as artists, do we limit ourselves by saying, I can only play a Black person living in the moment of this time of my life right now, if we have to adhere to the rules of you must be the thing that you are portraying? If that is not the case, then why is it not okay for a white actor to play Martin Luther King or a white actress to play Beneatha from A Raisin in the Sun? Now, we can talk about scarcity concept in terms of there's just not enough parts for us written anyway. But if we're looking at the role of an artist is to reflect back the world or to be the conduit for the world, if we start putting ourselves in these very restrictive categories, what does that do to art?
Well, first of all, I don't think we can skip over the scarcity issue, right? Because this, again, to harken back to the ground on which I stand and people who've spoken before, but of course, August Wilson, the point is that the governance and the financing of theater has always been inequitable. So when you have financing and governance that is inequitable, you get stories. This is how I moved from actress to producer in my life. Because I said, well, I'm not going to play another conjurer or exotic or nurse, right? And so in order for me to have the roles and the representation that I would like and explore, because if I'm good enough, I can be Juliet. If I'm good enough, I can play this. Sometimes it's if I'm good enough, and sometimes it's if there's enough bias removed from the process at the institution you're studying at. But that's a whole other conversation. Because people have to be able to see your humanity, to see past the fact that or see that you could actually be bringing this character in this culture, right? So there's so much here. But what I will say is, I don't want to leap over that because I think that that's a big thing. But I also want to say that it leads directly to the fact that there have not been enough opportunities. Why would you cast white actors and have them put on yellow face and tape their eyes? Why would you put on blackface when there are a multitude of talented actors where you could cast them? There's nothing wrong with people wanting to experience the culture of other people. And I think that there is room for art to do that. But you have, to me, you only get the right to do that when we have provided an equal playing ground and there's enough opportunity that has been afforded to everyone, right? And even with that, there's just things people will not understand. There's things about other people's culture that I don't understand, right? But, and I think this was answered by Denzel when he was asked the question, right? Only certain people are going to understand what it feels like to have a hot comb and put on your scalp and hold your ear, right? We recently did Midsummer Night's Dream in Harlem, Justin Emeka at the Pittsburgh Public Theater. And the reality is I was told by someone who was a white male, like, I didn't understand some of the jokes. And I'm glad I got to see it again because then I was able to go research and learn and laugh, right? If someone says, damn, 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 we're going to know, oh, that's Florida. Oh, her husband is dead. She's going to throw this thing. But that is because of the culture that we grew up in. So why would we not understand that in the study of a character, in the embodiment of an actor, those experiences matter in terms of what they would bring to a role? I am not getting to the fullness of everything you asked me, but what I will say is, I don't want to talk about you imitating my life when you don't respect it offstage, right? I don't want to talk about you playing and characterizing me and taking my work when you refuse to acknowledge me as a human being. I'm skipping around, but it's all relative. It's all connected to our experience as Black Americans, which is you want the right of access to my culture, but you don't want me. And this is not just a problem we have with Black people. This is a problem we have with actors, artists. We want the production. We want what they produce, but we don't want to give them healthcare, right? We don't want to give them what they deserve to be able to live and pay them in an equitable way, whatever race, whatever background, whatever. So I think that there is an issue in general in this country with the respect of people over production. And right. that permeates all things.
Well, it goes back to what you said in the manifesto for Damascus. You've created a system that you did not even want us to be a part of, right? That you didn't even consider us.
Right. So why would you want to tell my story?
I want to tell my story. Yes. We could do a whole hour on just that one question.
Just that one question. I'm like, ooh, we just are revving up to it. We're just getting into it.
We may come into it.
Okay.
No, but, you know, I think I wrestle with these questions because my mind works like that. I go, okay, well, you know, I'm getting to play in Hamilton. I could play George Washington. If I was doing musical theater, I'd be up for that part.
Right.
Right. But
it's one part. And look how long it took to get that type of thing onto Broadway stage.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's good for us to wrestle with these concepts because I think we need to sharpen our own understanding of where we stand in relation to that and answer the why.
Absolutely.
And the why not.
Honestly. Absolutely. Because people, either they don't understand, they don't want to understand, they have, you know, like there's all these things, but you need to be able to be clear about what it is that you're asking for and why. Also, because in this industry, we're always being tested against it, right? So you're going to come against, do I take that part or not? You're going to come against, do I, as a managing director, I'm going to come against, what are my values with regard to what we do on the stage in this way, right?
Shifting gears a little bit, and it's probably a cousin of this conversation that we're talking about. We're living in a world of cancel culture. Mm-hmm. We're living in a world where if you step wrong, say wrong, do wrong, you're out. There's no We are a judge, jury, and executioner in 2 seconds on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and your career is over. And I wonder how that impacts the theater and the creative process, because I think theater at its best is when it is controversial. Mm-hmm. Look at some of the greatest playwrights, some of the greatest movements in theater. Even Peter Brooks was a very controversial director, you know, and now we look at that as very staid and very, you know, easy to digest and understand. But how does this idea that we have to conform impact our ability to create art in the theater from your perspective?
I don't buy into that. I have to conform. I never have. I don't ever plan to. There is a little bit of conforming that we all do. No, I mean, this is a reality. There is a little bit of conforming that we all do, right? There's a little respectability politics sometimes that we all struggle with. So I also want to put that out there so people don't think I'm out here living, you know, the most radical life in the world. Like, I don't think that that's true either about me, although I do know that there are people who do live that way. But what I want to say is that I think that, first of all, I just don't understand the cancel culture thing. I think that part of what we have done by not engaging with one another and having conversations and being challenged, and you can't challenge people. And this is also just on the job as well, right? This is a concern I have as now a managing director. Like, you just can't even tell people that their work is not good, right? You can't even tell people this is actually just not good. They're going to find a reason why this is like an offense beyond an offense. And really, it's just that they should own accountability, perhaps, for what it is that they need to, you know, some cult. We need to be able to take criticism. But we live in a society where that is lacking, to your point. We don't even have good, some would argue. You can look at what's happening in New York or other places, and even in Pittsburgh. We don't even have good cultural criticism anymore in terms of the journalism and the writing and the ability to dissect a history and apply it to a current situation and figure out the nuances. You have people writing about the audience members and the curtain speech and not the work itself, right? And its place in society. So I'm gonna cut this answer short, but I will just say that I think, one, we have to learn how to disagree again.
Ooh.
Two, we have to learn that the how consists of the way in which we engage with one another. And I think that it all still reverts back to how we view one another, because it requires respect, right? The word respect means like to hear again, to go back, to listen again. I'm not doing that if I don't see you as someone worthy of my time. I still laugh at people who will see me in all the newspapers or in announcements about my career. But if I'm wearing something on the streets of Pittsburgh and I look a little too cultural or something, they won't even know who I am.
Wow.
But I know who you are. And I don't ever, no matter what you're wearing or what I can identify you, but there is a way that I can be dismissed. There is a way that I can be not seen if I'm not in the appropriate setting by which you would recognize me as who I am.
I'm just taking that in for a minute. Because it's all one. And as we start to peel back the layers of these very complex topics, it does center down to just an essential idea. An essential fact is that if you don't value another human being's experience on any level, you can't even have the disagreement if you don't even value the person you're disagreeing with.
I can't even hear what you're saying.
And I think that's what we start drilling down to in these very fundamental. It's like the noise. It's like the noise is, can so-and-so play this role? Can so-and-so do this? But it starts getting down to, how do you view the humanity of the person standing in front of you?
Because it's really, do I think you have the capacity?
Capacity. Right.
Right. And what it really is a reflection of often is not the capacity of the actor or the capacity. It's the capacity of the one with the power to see things differently than their privileged position and experiences have led them to see.
Yeah.
That's why, like, I probably would have been the worst actress, because I probably would have left every audition like, it's not me, it's you. What are you talking about?
I'm good.
What? It ain't me, it's you.
So I was thinking about you and this cultural moment that we're in, and started looking around the landscape of the American theater, and I found the Taki Garrett at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I found Dominic Moroso at the Detroit Public Theater, Patricia McGregor at the New York Theater Workshop, Hannah Sharif at the Repertory Theater of St. Louis, all Black women who have stepped into these four phenomenal organizations that prior to them have been run by white people. But I look at these four women who all had incredibly difficult and still have incredibly difficult roads into these positions they're in. So much so for Miss Garrett, she had to hire security.
Right.
Over a play. Right. Let's talk about that. She had to hire security for her family over a play. And then I look at you stepping into, you know, this very elevated position in Pittsburgh. And I wonder, we are in this moment of inclusion, a spirit of inclusion, a spirit of representation. And I wonder how this will impact the face of theater and art as we continue to move forward. And also, what pushback are we going to have as we continue to hope to try to create institutions that are more reflective of the world that we live in today?
I just told you I finished my first week. I'm still in my honeymoon, and I'm like, I'm not going to have any pushbacks because I want everybody to come. I want the older white people who don't know anything about this type of show or this type of culture to come. And I think it's the institution's job to educate. I think it's not just education or community engagement. When they asked me in my interview, I said, the first thing you need to do is get rid of this concept of community engagement. And they looked at me like I was crazy. I said, because everybody should be being engaged. Respect should be had for everyone. The reality is we have, and we know this in the history of theater, said community engagement means go to the Black community, go to the Latino community, go bring the people of color in, or go bring those of lesser class in. But the reality is everybody should be being engaged. So for me, which harkens back to your earlier question, it is not the great and fertile ground of the American theater if everybody cannot be included. The old and the new, the young, everyone, right? I love the stories. I'm reading the articles about these women. Your listing them has encouraged me to reach out. Like I plan to write to each of them. And I know that, you know, there's few degrees of separation. So they're very close. Many people I know who know them. But what I think, I'm going to say just unedited what I think. And then if I don't answer the question, you can let me know. But Black women have made a life out of making a dollar out of 15 cents. And the American theater is in a place now where it needs the expertise and skills that we have. And it is almost so challenged that it's willing to allow for people who are just as qualified to come and perhaps show them a different way, right? And I don't know the women well enough, but I can imagine from what I'm reading, what they, like you said, have had to endure to get to the place that they are. But what I want to also lift up are the names of Candace Jackson and Shea Wafer and Tiffany Ellis and all these women who could have been in managing directors of Lord Theaters multiple years ago, Baraka Saleh, all of these Black women who chose not to go into the regional theater or to be managing directors. And I think that that has to be examined, right? Because it wasn't just, we didn't want the jobs, but I remember going to my first Lord conference and I was like, oh, this is not for me. I was not in mind.
Yeah.
Right. And this is not just in the American theater. Well, what I want to also offer is even in philanthropy, there were white men that were heads of institutions that I was their program officer, and they would always go to my supervisor or to the president, and they refused to talk to me about their organization because of this dynamic of who should be in power, who you should feel you have to respond to or report to. And that oftentimes never feels like it should be a Black woman. Mind you, I think if you look back at many of these histories of these organizations, there were Black women in the business offices. There were Black women. There were always someone was there doing some work. But I'm glad that we are now in the fore. I want to do two things. Dispel the myth that we're here to save the world. because we're just here to do work like everybody else and every other white man and white woman has had the opportunity to do, win, lose, draw. We have the right to just work and do the best that we can and not make miracles happen, although we always do. And then I also want to just say that I think that in terms of pushback, we know what can happen. Subscriptions can drop. Donors can go away. There can be hate mail, right? I've worked in many situations. People wouldn't imagine. I interned at the New York Knicks when I was younger. You wouldn't imagine the hate mail that came into Patrick Ewing, racist hate mail. I worked at the August Wilson Center for African American Culture here in Pittsburgh. We used to get faxes from the KKK with Barack Obama's face on toilet paper, faxed daily to us. These are real things that I don't think people realize happen. I have to be careful. In any situation, I'm always mindful of what is being said when you're releasing a press release about me. How are you launching me? How are you caring? So I think this is a great opportunity for the American theater to learn what it looks like to support leaders of color, what it is that we need. And it is going to be an interesting experiment in terms of power and how people respond to us in these positions. But I promise, if they come alongside, we can make something beautiful happen in American theater. And those women already are.
The thing that we have to get to the root of is why they don't want to come along side by side. You know, all the studies show that when you have integrated schools, the white kids do better. The black kids do better. When you don't have integrated schools, they both suffer.
Absolutely.
There is a desire within the human spirit to be together.
Yes.
And the more we fight that and the more that we run from that,
yes,
the more we literally endanger the survival of our species.
Absolutely. But it takes courage. It takes courage. And this is why I talk about this in Damascus about failing, right? If you look at places like Stanford's design school, I went there for boot camp. You have to literally celebrate failure. They make you say, like, I failed. Yay. I failed. Yay. People in power and privilege are not afraid to fail. They know it's necessary and they iterate, right? But we feel and have been raised to believe we cannot fail because we may not get another chance. We cannot fail. And so there's an enormous amount of pressure that actually restricts our creativity and our growth because we are so concerned about being judged against one instance of failure or being seen in a certain way. And I think this is the danger when you ask about cancel culture and ask about these things. This is the danger of putting your identity and its value in the hands of other people instead of it being deeply rooted in who you know you are in any given moment.
When I thought about doing this show, I shot almost the entire first season before I released the first episode. And I shot the first episode in February of 2021. And didn't release it until October. And the reason I didn't do it was because I was like, what if I fail? Mm-hmm. And I finally had to say, if I fail, I fail. And I had to also be comfortable standing behind what I said.
Absolutely.
What have you learned from your failures?
Mm-hmm. They're necessary. They are the best teachers. Mm. They're often not as bad as I paint them to be. I am my worst critic. But they have been the things that I've grown from the most. I have learned a tremendous amount from my failures that has taught me just things that I pay attention to in terms of my blind spots when I'm leading now.
You also said something interesting in the Damascus, I call it a manifesto. I don't know if you would call it that, but I felt like it was a real manifesto. And you talked about not only was the work going to be unapologetically Black, but it was going to be unapologetically faith-filled.
That's
right. And can a truly faith-filled play find voice in the current paradigm of the American theater today?
It already has. First of all, it's the origin of theater, right? Number one, it started as ritual and religion, like number one.
Right.
And it's called dithyrambs, and it's called the Mystery Cycle, and it's called Dionysus, and it's called We Need Fertility and Wine and Water and the Gods, and please, it already has. It is the origin, which is the part of the problem that I'm not understanding why people don't understand. Secondly, it's called Jesus Christ Superstar, Nonsense. It's called the Book of Mormon. It's called, right? There's all these are Broadway shows. Hits.
Hits.
Now, do you view that the same as my gospel musical of Esther set in a Black church? I don't know. In fact, I do know, because Tyler Perry had to create his own. But you see where he is in terms of the industry. Whatever people think about the work, the people he's talking to value the work and its representation of their lives, right? And so, and I mentioned him because of faith and his depiction of the church, not just, you know, race. But so I think that, you know, for me, it's always, no one can tell me when it's separated, right? Officially, there was always a mask, and it had to do with this relationship with God. It's painted on the cave walls, right? So for me, Damascus is not an innovation. It's the original. It's the original. It's a hearkening. It's a renaissance. It's a remembering of what it's supposed to be.
Right.
Which is deeply connected in community, deeply religious. And I don't mean that in a way that is like, you know, I mean that in the way of community, faith. Because if we really talk about what faith means, that can mean a number of things to different people. For me, I go to Hebrews 11 and 1. Substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That could be a number of things. You have faith when you sit down at your seat, at your job, in the desk, that chair is going to hold you.
Right.
That's a faith. But what do we put our faith in, right, is the question. And how do I value your faith according to mine? But the reality is, even if we talk about Christ, Catholicism, Mormon, they have always had a place, and there's always been a commentary about people's faith walks inside of the theater.
You just used the word dithyramb, which made me laugh a little bit, because now people are having to go, like, they're gonna have to Google it. Anyone who uses that word loves theater, and I want to know where your love of theater came from and who nurtured that within you.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so I'll go right there. My church, right there, Easter plays. I'm young. That's my earliest, one of my earliest memories is like, you have to get up, you have to memorize this Easter thing. You get dressed up and you stand in front of the church, and it might have been Jesus Wept, but that was your performance, right? I remember those things. My family, my mother ran the kind of the cultural hub, the after-school program in our community, where you come and do your homework, you get the free lunch, you do. So there were kids always there. She took us to see Serafina. She took us to see The Lion King. She took us to see Annie. My great-grandparents went to go see Their Arms Are Too Short to Box with God. My grandmother was a Red Hat lady. So, you know, she's doing all the bus trips to the, you know, like, this was what I grew up in. And so that's number one. My first job was at the American Red Cross. My mother didn't want to teach me about the birds and the bees. So they had these peer educators that talked about HIV and AIDS in the 90s. We would talk to other teens, but we would use skits and theater. And so I didn't know I would end up with a career in theater at the time, but these have been the seeds. This is why I love it. And then there, of course, were the mentors and the people that I've met who just wove some seed in my life. And so here we are.
You and your husband have 4 children. How do you balance that, being a mom, with also innovating, changing what the American theater can be?
Oh my goodness. I've had this conversation a couple of times. I just was actually talking to Mariah about it, because neither of us have actually given birth to children. And we both think it's because of our careers. That by the time we actually got to a place where we could feel financially stable, we were late 30s. And it was kind of like, well, it's a little too, it is never too late. But, you know, for us, we were just like, you know, and I remember different men telling me, like, look at Oprah, look at this, when they're not married, you'll never be married. And so for me, not only because of the desire to restore that which had been ripped from me, the Black family, it was always important for me to feel like I want to get married. People still stare at my husband and I when we're walking as a couple in Pittsburgh. Like, I don't think they often see married Black couples with kids here. And that's not everywhere, right? And it's not everyone's story. I have no problem with interracial dating. I think love is love. You can fall in love with anybody. I just think there is this weirdness that people are not used to seeing that unit. And so how do I don't balance it very well. You know, they're downstairs having pizza night. And this is not to make you, they know this is my job, my love. My husband knew this when he met me. But this is another reason why I never had this stipulation of like, I don't want to marry a man with kids. I was like, I do, because I'm not going to probably have that experience. And so, okay, you got four kids. Great. Let's go. You know, it was like, you know, from his, you know, you've been married before. Great. You'll have knowledge that I don't have, because I've been out here travailing from Chicago to New York trying to create a career. So I felt as though I had to follow the opportunity. Although what I realized all along is that I was the opportunity. I didn't get that until I got to Pittsburgh and I was in my 30s. So I will just say I'm married to a man who likes for me to cook. So it's very hard to come home after a long day and still try to put something together. And I don't always do it right or well. And especially being a blended family, there's a lot of dynamics. But I'm doing the best that I can. And I have to shut off my phone sometimes. And I have to not put my email on my phone. And I have to set boundaries. That's what I try to do.
This season of the show, I've been asking people if they have found their voice or if they're in the process of finding their voice. And if they have found their voice, what they want to say with their platform. And I ask you that question.
I believe that I've always known I had a strong voice. I believe I struggled for some time with people who didn't want to hear it or my fear of their impression of me. At this point in my life, it's not so much about my own voice and what I want to say. It really is about being a vessel in my life right now and saying what it is that God would have me to speak in this season to people who need to hear it. And when I say that, I don't mean that in any way other than the voice of love, the voice of joy, restoration, peace, and the ways in which I can either help amplify those types of voices, come alongside as a chorus member for those who are speaking from those types of voices or possess those types of voices. And then in any moment that I'm asked to and put in position, make sure that when I open my mouth, I'm speaking from that place.
Shonda, thank you so much for your time today and your wisdom and your words. I'm so happy that to know you.
Thank you. This has been a blessing. I'm so grateful for this opportunity. And just, you know, when you find someone where you can speak all of the things, right? We can speak about theater. We can speak about life. We can speak about faith. We can speak about generosity and giving and love and what that means in the American theater, what that means for our humanity. This space is so important. You are so important. You are affirming me, even in a moment of uncertainty. And so it comes at a time where I'm so grateful for it. And I am just excited about the way in which you're going to impact so many other people's lives. And I'm just grateful for you putting away that fear and launching this amazing platform. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for shining a light, because your voice and your light is needed.
Thank
and
you.
That's why people are responding. So thank you. Thank you, Shonda.
Thank you, Patrick.
To those of you who are watching or listening, remember, we all have a voice. Use yours wisely. Bye, everyone. And go get some pizza, Shonda.
Yes.
All right.